Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James. This is Pete.
Hello, everyone.
It is episode 70, and it is the 27th of July. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We are going to be talking to Sean Jacobs, author of What Winners Don't Cheat.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be talking about his story, about the book and some of the issues that come out of that. We're also going to be talking to IPA Research Fellow Andrew Bushnell. We're going to be getting pretty deep dive into it. It was a bit of a long interview. Going to be talking about his new proposal for changing criminal justice reforms in South Australia, bringing in community corrections, what the issues there are there. And we're also going to be talking pretty deep dive on the James Gunn getting fired and, like, you know, to what extent can outrage mobs online bring people down, and, you know, it doesn't make a difference when they're left wing or right wing.
Andrew really brings out the philosopher in me.
You had a furrowed brow for that interview.
He compels me to think more deeply about the world around me, James.
Well, I'm glad. I encourage that in you, and I want to see more of it. So let's get Bushnell back on a bit more. Let's get into the main stories this week. So as always, we are joined by Nina Lowe and Arthur, pressing the buttons.
Hi.
Pete always picks me up on that, and it's good.
It's weird to sit here without saying g'day.
Yes. Cool. So let's get into the main stories of the week. So do we want to start with My Health or Nine and Fairfax?
Do Nine and Fairfax.
Okay, cool. So this one is all over the papers at the moment. So
what's left of them?
Yeah, exactly. So it's one of the biggest media deals ever seen in Australia. Nine and Fairfax have announced the plans for a $4 billion merger. So the name Fairfax is going to disappear from the media landscape. So, you know, that's The Age, the Sydney Morning Herald. I think the Courier Mail over in Queensland. I might be wrong about that one. But definitely The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, two massive papers. They've been bought by Nine, and there's been a whole lot of controversy. Like, when I originally read this, I was like, oh, man, it finally happened, because it's been talked about for a while, but I didn't really see a whole lot of issues with it. You know, reporting is reporting, and if it's good reporting, it's good reporting. People are going to read it, but everyone's freaking out online about it.
Oh, I'm surprised.
Yeah. So, well, the main one being Paul Keating. So, former Prime Minister called it an exceptionally bad development and said it would reduce the diversity of news and opinion in Australia. And he's quote, I don't know, he's got it in for Channel 9 for some reason. But anyway, so he says, if in the arranged announcement Channel 9 has a majority stock, then Channel 9 will run the editorial policy.
Mm.
Basically saying, like, oh, we can't trust Channel 9 with these papers, and I don't really get it.
He said, didn't he say they've had the opportunism of an alley cat
for the
last 50 years?
Like, what? Did they run a bad story on him, like, 20 years ago, and he's just never forgotten it?
He wouldn't like Channel 9. No. But that's a bit rich from the bloke who adopted the four pillars bank policy in 1990 as treasurer and prevented competition from happening.
That's the kind of philosophical Pete that Andrew Bushnell brings out. It's gone into Friday morning.
Yeah.
I like it. So if you want to read more about this, so again, like, I come at it as just one company's bought another, and I don't really see the free speech, I don't really see the open debate kind of problems here. It's two private organizations that have bought each, one private organization has merged with another. If you want to read more about it, so John Roskam, executive director here at the IPA, had an article about it in the Australian Financial Review this morning, which I really liked. Got a few quotes here from it. And to me, this is the main point. The merger is the best opportunity any journalist currently working at Fairfax Media has of keeping their job. Like, when you think about how struggling Fairfax is, and John mentions that they cut 115 newsroom staff in the Sydney Morning Herald, Age, Brisbane Times, not Courier Mail, Brisbane Times, and WA Today. Like, 115 journalists lost their jobs. Like, Fairfax was circling the drain there for a while, and now a whole lot of journalists are going to be able to keep employed because Nine's there. Like, you can talk about, oh, there's not enough diversity, but, you know, there's less diversity when there's a whole bunch of journalists who have to go find another job because they can't compete anymore.
That is true, mate. And of course, we haven't talked about yet the $1 billion elephant in the room. Yeah, so obviously, you know, this is the ABC's fault, all the ABC's fault. The other thing is, if people are concerned about independent news...
Do you want to expand on why it's the ABC's fault?
Because they created that Fairfax,
there
that
it is.
Same cool. market.
Yeah, I just felt we needed to just unpack that a little.
Yep. That's good, James. It's important to.
Well, and it's also like, as John points out in his article, it's like you got Nine and Fairfax, and then they're up against these giant companies like Google, Facebook, Instagram. Like, they're the ones that people are going to for news these days, and Nine and Fairfax just can't compete with that.
Well,
and like with Nine, they still won't be able to compete with that, but they'll be a little more able to.
Yeah, exactly. And look, as we always say, you know, people have more access to news now than they ever had before. And as I was getting to before, if people want independent reporting, come to the Young IPA Podcast.
Yes, absolutely. Wait, we do reporting now?
Well, I mean, distilling.
Distill. We're a distiller.
What's the other thing? Yeah, let's stick with the Stoic. We're Stoic.
Cool. So, yeah, if you want to read more about that, so John Roskam's got an article on the IPA website, as does Evan Mulholland, and he talks a bit more about the ABC angle. And, you know, people freak out because it's like, oh, this, you know, company's like, it's going to have a TV, it's going to have a paper, it's going to have all these other things. And it's like, yeah, so does the ABC. So, if you're freaking out about that, we can think of another one. Pete, let's talk about My Health.
Okay, well, this is an emerging
concept,
story.
Not, yeah. Don't just have an intervention for me. I like McDonald's and I'm not going to stay away from it.
5 servings of vegetables a day, James. No, okay.
Absolutely so not.
Health Minister Greg Hunt said, the big story this week about My Health was Greg Hunt, the Health Minister, said that My Health records won't be accessed by police without court order. So you need a warrant to check people's health records.
So My Health Record is like this online portal where everyone's health record's going to be, and it's going to be there like 30 years after you die. And it's just going to sit there.
Well, as I was going to say, my health records are...
I thought we needed a bit of background before we got into the warrant stuff.
Yeah, so they're a single unified patient record currently used by 6 million Australians. At the moment, you have to opt in to use it, right? So if you don't want it, you don't have to. But from October 15, you'll automatically be added. So everyone will be on it. And it's a very controversial issue. But this bloke from... Where is he from? Where is he from? The Parliamentary Library. Nigel Brew represents, he said that actually there's nothing in the legislation which says that police need a warrant, and that this represents a significant reduction in the legal threshold for the release of private medical information to law enforcement. So Greg Hunt probably doesn't know the actual legislation about this. The ADHA...
Well, they got the library to take that down yesterday. Like, they removed that advice. So, but like, even if the librarian went a bit off the... radar, like he went off message about it. So safe to say, there's confusion.
Yeah. There's confusion.
The Queensland Police Union is still saying that no warrant will be required to its members. Like, if the police are being told you don't need a warrant, then there is confusion.
Yeah, like they think they're fine.
Yeah.
The Australian Digital Health Agency, which looks after the records, says no documents have been released in the last 6 years, and none will be released in the future without a court order or a coronial or similar order. But that's just your policy. You could change that at any time.
Yeah, exactly.
So, look, this is a big story.
And look, I don't want to, make anyone scared here, but there's... but there's these things called internet hackers, and, you know, they don't need a warrant. They don't ask for a warrant. They just go in and they get your health record details.
Yeah, that's right.
So, pretty scary stuff.
It's pretty bad.
But it's opt-in, Pete. So, no, it's opt-out. That's a bad thought.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm sure, like, every Australian out there is thinking, you know, they're right on this and they're about to opt out. And the other thing, it's just like the data retention stuff. Like, they say, oh no, this is how we're going to use it now. But then a few years down the track, it's like, oh no, it's good if our financial regulator also had access to your health records.
Yeah. Just in case.
Yep.
Just in case something comes up.
Opt out. I haven't opted out yet.
No, because like there was more than one page I needed a view on the web side, and that sort of made my eyes glaze over a little. And this weekend. It's a Sunday James thing.
Yeah, admin day. I find that personal admin difficult. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, carry on.
I call it something else, but I probably can't repeat it on a family show. Cool. So do we want to talk Trump trade war?
So on Tuesday, Trump announced a $12 billion subsidy to US farmers to weather a growing trade war with China, the EU and others, which is, he began. So, you know, that's great. The Senator Ben Sasson, I hope I pronounced that correctly, from Nebraska, who's very critical of the president, said this trade war is cutting the legs out from under farmers, and the White House's plan is to spend $12 billion on gold crutches, which I thought was a reasonable turn of phrase. Trump also met Juncker from the EU yesterday at the White House, yesterday at Washington time, and he and Trump sort of decided to expand European imports of European imports of US liquefied natural gas and soybeans, and lower industrial tariffs on both sides. Mr. Trump said, and the US and the European Union will hold off on other tariffs while negotiations proceed, which is a good thing. They're going to work towards zero tariffs on industrial goods. Also, according to Mr. Trump, that's a good thing, but it's worth noting that there has been a negotiation for years between the EU and the US called the TTIP, and that Trump has suspended it. So look, if all this is part of some broader negotiation where we end up with freer trade, then great.
Yeah.
But at the moment, it looks pretty dire.
Well, it looks better than it did a few days ago, because like it was like, you know, he tweeted out tariffs are good and was talking about how great tariffs are, and then there seems to be a massive reduction in tariffs.
That's the threshold.
Yeah, but like, you know, we're closer to no tariffs than we are to more tariffs. I don't know. I think that was a good thing. But one thing I did want to point out, which I think you mentioned, the EU agreed to import more American soybeans.
Yes, so important.
Very important. Because like this is all part of Trump's plan, turn Europe into a continent of soy boys, go over and conquer. foolproof. This is all, you're all missing the main story.
Did you write that out yourself?
Yes.
That's good.
Thank
That's
you.
Good. I mean, and look.
To I'm sure a million people made the same joke.
Really? But, I didn't think of it. Yeah. There's, and as we know, I'm a comedic genius. So, but I mean, the thing is, there'll be lots of, all our listeners in Europe and soybean
Well, we do
fans,
have some in Sweden, as we found out when we looked at the Spotify analytics.
Your soybeans will become increasingly affordable as time goes on.
Well, just look out, though.
If this
don't
happens.
Let it get you. Don't become. Cool. All right. So we'll move on to another story here. So this one got a lot of play. We featured in Hey What I Miss, and we won't go too much into the details because we really get into the get into the deeper issues with Andrew Bushnell later. But anyway, so last week we were talking about how Mark Duplass, the director, said, "Hey, you guys should follow Ben Shapiro, it's worth hearing," and that created a Twitter storm, and he apologized.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, one of the people that got himself involved in this is the director James Gunn, who people might know from the two Guardians of the Galaxy movies, and he did a few indie movies before then.
Yeah.
So he said he was very critical of Ben Shapiro, and he's like, "Mark Duplass, you know, don't hold this endorsement of Ben Shapiro against Mark Duplass. I don't like Ben Shapiro, blah, blah, blah." To which there's like this alt-right guy on Twitter, Mike Cernovich, big on Pizzagate, just to give you an idea of what this guy's about.
He invented Pizzagate, didn't he?
Did he invent it?
I think
I just thought he was like, you know.
I
thought he just really bigged it up a lot.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Say, this is, yeah.
Look.
This is like
associated
itself.
With
yeah.
Pizzagate.
In, yeah. I was going to say involved.
No, to say involved.
I did not say he's involved. Anyway,
so that's the kind of guy he is. So he goes, well, you know, him and his followers go through all of James Gunn's old tweets, and they find some pretty terrible stuff. Like 10 years ago, James Gunn was very out there, like experimental filmmaking and very experimental with his tweets, and they were not good, and I'm not going to repeat them on the show. But they, you know, started to retweet them, started to share them around. And then Marvel, like the guys who make Guardians of the Galaxy, they fired James Gunn from the upcoming one. Like James Gunn had already written the script for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. That's gone. He's out. And like, you know, we see this a lot, like the outrage mob, they find these tweets and then they get the person fired, like Roseanne Barr being the most recent example. There's a million others. But this one was interesting because it was like a right-wing Twitter mob went after a left-wing director and got them fired. Like usually it's the other way around. So really interesting story. We'll be talking about Andrew Bushnell because like I go and talk about the Lawrence Southern angle as well. Like why does Lawrence Southern not have to pay $68,000 but it's okay for James Gunn to be fired? Like I think the thing is like I don't... If I can speak for both of us, Pete, Marvel are completely...
Absolutely not.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'll withdraw. I speak for myself here. Marvel are absolutely in their right to fire James Gunn, but I don't think they should have.
I don't care. Okay. Yeah. I don't care that they fired him. I'm more interested in what, you know, this loose coalition of dissidents we call the right. I don't think we should be getting involved in...
Yeah, outrage mobs.
Kind of that's it.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. So we'll talk about that more with Bushnell.
Other people here think, other people in the IPA think that we should. So it's a bit of
an
internal
discussion. Like if they're going to do it to us, we should do it to them. Yep. Is that kind of thing?
Like nuclear...
So, mutually assured destruction.
Proliferate. Yeah, that's it.
Well, yours is a peace one. Mine's the war one.
Well...
Anyway,
yes.
Cool. So
we do nuclear policy next.
Yes. We'll be talking to Bushnell about that, so stick around in the show later for that. Last story we'll talk about here. So Venezuela, the socialist paradise, the unbelievable test case for what socialism can look like.
Yep.
Don't you dare ever criticize anything involved with them or Sean Penn will be on your butt. They are in a bit of hot water at the moment.
Yep, carry on.
So the IMF has unveiled a new prognosis for Venezuela, saying the hyperinflation is poised to be going past 1,000,000% at an annualized rate.
Yep.
That's a lot of percent.
Oh, that's
a high amount of percent.
It's higher than they would be happy with.
Yeah, it's higher than Australia. Awful thing. Like, you know, we could... Every week, there's a new story of how bad things are getting in Venezuela. Like, people having to go cross-country just to do grocery shopping.
Yep.
But I do like this. So, President Nicolas Maduro, this is bad. 1,000,000%. It's not great. His bold new proposal, it's not to liberalize the markets. It's not to increase foreign investment. It is to remove 5 zeros from the Bolivar currency rather than the 3 zeros originally planned. Let's do it. I'm happy with that.
That's called reacting to the
getting to the core of the issue.
Yeah, good governance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just like printing money to solve an economic crisis. Oh, that's right. Most governments in the West do that.
And that's what they got into. I just like that is like official government policy of sweeping something under the rug. Like if we just remove the 5 zeros, then no one will realize what we've done.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here. Cool.
The IMF compared Venezuela with Germany in 1923 and Zimbabwe in the 2000s.
Yeah. And bad things happened after that. that happens. So that is it for stories we want to talk about at the start. So we'll go to those interviews with Andrew Bushnell and Sean Jacobs now. Before we do, we'll just go through some of this other stuff that the IPA said this week. So on our website, Andrew Bushnell, we talked to him later in the show about it, but if you want to read more about his criminal justice work, there's the parliamentary research brief that is available on our website. And if you head on over to our Facebook and YouTube pages, you can see a short video he's made talking through the proposals. You've also got Matthew Lesh, IPA Research Fellow, his work on small businesses in Australia, showing that 330,000 employment in small business is 330,000 less over the last decade.
Yes.
So that got featured in the front page article in The Australian. So you can go read that article in The Australian. You could also read Lesh's research on our website. You also had Gideon Rosner speaking to Bill English. We featured that in the show last week. That's now up on our YouTube page if you want to go see the interview. And Evan Mulholland, our media and communications guy, he is in The Spectator Australia today on the Nine Fairfax merger and the ABC deal. Cool. So yeah, thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast. Thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify. If you want to get involved on that one, if you want your friends to get involved and they don't have iTunes, go through the Spotify. You can also listen on our website. If you are listening on iTunes, make sure you leave us a 5-star review. Really helps us out with the rankings. And you can also leave a comment for the show. Nina, if people want to take more of a financial investment in the IPA and they want to become involved, how can they become a member? How can they donate?
Well, just visit the website ipa.org.au and click on that join button or that donation button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Cool. Let's go to those interviews now. Okay. We now welcome back to the show once again, IPA Research Fellow Andrew Bushnell, one of our best friends here. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Cool.
Good to see you, mate.
Jeez, you too, Pete.
Good on you, Pete.
That wasn't weird at all.
Yeah, not at all. So he's not very good at introductions, as Peter Gregory. But anyway, let's get into it. So big week for you. So big day for you. Today, we're recording this on Thursday. We've released this new parliamentary research brief from you. It's talking about a pretty radical, pretty out there, but new proposal to go into criminal justice. Do you want to explain what it is to the listeners and to me and Pete?
Yeah, so we did a parliamentary research brief for South Australian parliamentarians this week, talking about a way to reform community service to make it both more of a punishment and more rehabilitative. So to try and hit both of those goals. This is a South Australian version of an argument that was developed in a paper that came out a couple of months ago called Making Community Corrections Work. And the main idea behind it is to improve community service by opening up the bidding for offender labour, as it's known, from community groups and voluntary organisations to private businesses. And the effect that this would have would be that offenders would be doing more work, more complex work, and getting paid for it. So the model we're proposing is a labour hire model. So businesses that wanted to participate, now whether that's because they need the labour or because they want to do some sort of civil society outreach type thing. Businesses that wanted to participate would bid for access. They would pay a fee to the Department of Corrections. And the Department of Corrections would then pay the workers probably realistically the minimum wage. And the idea there is to create a connection for offenders between doing the right thing and getting a reward. It's also to address what is really the fundamental problem of community service at the moment, which is that on average, offenders are doing far fewer hours of work than they're sentenced to. So
yeah, cool. So let's talk about how we got here. So that was a stat that really jumped out at me in the parliamentary research brief was that the offenders are sentenced to do community service and they're not doing as many hours as they are told to do. So why is that?
Yeah, so there's the stat is nationwide, and this is the national average doesn't include New South Wales. It doesn't report this statistic, but nationwide, on average, offenders are sentenced to 78 hours of community service, but they perform only 41 hours. And there's two reasons for that, two main reasons. One is that people often don't comply with the terms of their release into the community, and so they get put back into prison, right? So that cuts their number of hours down. But The completion rate of community service orders around the country is more than 70%, so it doesn't account for that disparity altogether. The rest of that disparity is actually explained by the lack of suitable work. So when you think about community service, you're probably thinking about things like people working, you see them sometimes in parks and public spaces, removing graffiti, raking leaves,
that kind of thing.
But there's just not enough of that work for all of the people who are involved in these plans. And so often they're released, having the judge just says, well, we're satisfied that you've done enough hours, you've complied with the terms, so you're out. And what we're trying to do, right, is to address that shortfall of available hours. We want to increase the amount of work that's actually required of people in this system, because that's, more corrective. So it's more sort of, it's more of a punishment, right? I mean, when I say to you that they're only doing half of the hours they're sentenced to, you think, well, they're getting away with something, right? We don't want that. But we don't want people just doing busy work. We want people doing work that more closely models the kinds of work that they need to do in their own lives to become productive citizens, because we know that that is correlated really strongly with reduced reoffending.
So this will help people once they get out, they'll be able to more easily find a job.
Well, that's the goal, right? The ultimate goal of corrections, and the reason why we don't have just, say, a department of punishment, is because punishment is one of our goals, and it's probably the most important one. In a society like ours that is predicated on individuals having rights against one another, retribution and punishment, that's how we vindicate those rights. So that's very important. But we don't have a department of retribution, right? We have a department of corrections. Corrections is a normative exercise. It implies that there is a correct way for people to behave. And so what we're trying to do when we take people into the Department of Corrections is we want to reform their behaviour so that they don't re-offend once we release them into the community again.
Yeah, so this is the main point here, because I know when the report came out, the Twitter trolls, they're gonna come at the IPA no matter what we do. We could just say jelly beans for babies and they'll find something to hate.
But sugar, with this one, big sugar.
What are you guys hiding? but anyway, with this one, there seemed to be an idea that we were throwing offenders into corporate slavery. It was basically the idea that people were coming up with. But really, what you're doing with this proposal, if South Australia went ahead with this proposal, and hopefully if other state governments start doing it as well, we've got a bunch of criminals who we are going to help get on a better path. They'll at least pick up a skill or pick up some sort of opportunity that they'll be able to hopefully turn into paid productive work when their time's up.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we were expecting a little bit of a pushback along these lines, right? Which is this idea that you're sort of undercutting, you're kind of undercutting the labour market in some way. But the important thing is that, first, governments can sort of protect against that by doing sort of labour market testing and, by working with the companies involved. So I don't think that's much of a concern. But this overarching concern that people seem to have is this idea that if people are forced to do work and they're doing work for a company that makes a profit, then that company is profiting from the criminal justice system. Now, there's a couple of things you could say to that. One is that right now, community service is defined as unpaid labour. So there's a whole lot of work getting done. In New South Wales, for example, the amount of work that community service offenders do is valued at about $10 million annually.
Yes, and they get nothing for it.
And they get nothing. Yeah. Right, so already people are profiting, in a sense, from this labour, everyone but the offenders. The other thing is that what we want to do is we want to increase, like I said, not just the quantity of work, but the quality of it. And what businesses can offer are roles for people in community service that are more like the kinds of jobs that we want them to have so that they can be, upstanding, independent citizens. And that's the ultimate goal. That's the ultimate normative goal of corrections, is to say, this is the kind of person that we want you to be if you're going to be a free individual in our society. And work underpins that, not just for offenders, but for all of us. Work is the key to a good life, so it's also the key to corrections.
Yeah, absolutely. So, because for me, I don't care if it's the government or basically all of us by extension, I guess, but the government or corporations, I don't care who's getting the labor, but if there's someone who's working, that's learning a skill that's going to help them keep down a job and then not reoffend because they've got a steady source of income. I don't care if it's the government or the corporations that put them there. It's a good thing. Like, that's a fair thing.
It doesn't really make a difference whether the organisation that's running these schemes profits or not.
Yeah.
I mean, always, a community group in that sense that runs these kinds of programs also benefits, right? They might not have a profit that they record at the end of each, financial year and what they pay tax on, but they are benefiting from the labour, which is fine. I mean, that's what labour is for, right? It's to produce something. All I'm saying is that there's not enough of this work to go around. We want to increase the amount of work. We want to increase the quality of the work so that it's both more retributive by making people do the full measure of the sentence that the judge has laid down, and more rehabilitative by getting them to do work that is more like the kinds of work that they should be doing.
Cool, cool, cool. So that report is available on our website. You can download it now. There's also a media release that Bushnell put out, and there's you can find it by finding a very, very Albert Camus inspired photo of Andrew Bushnell. Like, you just go through the website, you'll find it.
Just staring into the middle distance.
Yeah, just like, what is he thinking about in that quote? I mean, I'm not wrong, but anyway, we'll move on to another topic. So, something that happened.
Camus inspired. I like that.
It's the first thing I thought when I saw it. Anyway, so again, visual gags for an audio podcast. But anyway, big news this week. So we talked about it on the show a bit already, so we probably don't need to get into the details. But James Gunn fired as director of the upcoming Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. I think he directed the first two. He got himself involved in, again, another thing we discussed in the podcast, that whole, give Ben Shapiro a follow. He got caught up in it. All these old disgusting tweets got brought out from 10 years ago. So my theory is James Gunn shouldn't have been fired. Like, I mean, they were 10 years old tweets. I don't think anyone was going to really rehash them again when Guardians of the Galaxy 3 came out. But we'll talk about, you do think James Gunn probably got what was coming. But, I want to get into a bit more of a philosophical thing that we were talking about in the office, which was James Gunn deserves to be fired, but then Lawrence Southern doesn't deserve to pay $68,000. Like, I think both of them are saying something that causes controversy. And then, obviously, if you say something in a free speech world, there is responsibility. Like, there is a reaction to your action, I guess. So let's talk about what is the difference between Lawrence Southern not paying $68,000 and James Gunn getting fired.
So the question that comes down to with James Gunn is whether his contract had a morality clause or something like that allowed, I think it's Disney, employers.
Or more directly Marvel, but yeah.
That allowed them to protect their brand from any association with him if he ever became a figure of public controversy. And I think, clearly he sort of erred, not just in making these tweets, but the fact that they're sort of still around. He obviously, he did apologize a few years ago for some of them, but not all of them.
Yeah, they got dug up a few years ago and it sort of went away, but then now it's just everywhere.
Yeah, so I mean, I would basically back in his employer's right to disassociate themselves from him if they think that their association with him is really costly. The difference between his situation and that of Lauren Southern is that Lauren Southern, as sort of noxious and annoying really as she may be, and her, she certainly doesn't speak for me, but the cost that's being imposed on her isn't from any of her employers or any of her fans, it's from the government. So there's a difference there. So if Lauren Southern says things that no one likes, then she won't be able to book a venue, she won't be able to sell any tickets, she won't be able to post videos on YouTube and make any money, right? And that would be a cost for her, equivalent to the cost that's imposed on James Gunn for saying a bunch of things that no one liked and that his employer didn't like. On top of that, Lauren Southern is also incurring the risk by saying of saying things that no one likes. There's this additional risk that's being imposed on her, which is that the state may well make it uncostly for her or impossible for her to afford to speak. So no one's really saying that James Gunn is losing his right to freedom of speech if he's not allowed to make another $300 million movie for Disney or Marvel. But for Lauren Southern, $68,000, which is what the police asked her for protection, is completely different really, because the state is sort of supposed to provide that security for everyone regardless. And Lauren Southern was in Australia legally.
In the end.
Well, after she applied for the right visa. Now, I've the Australian visa process is pretty complex, but it's not that complex. So I got no sympathy for her there. I don't really have any sympathy for her other than the fact that I don't think that taxpayers should be paying for police services twice, right? And we pay, now you say, oh, she's not a taxpayer, but she's here legally. The government, as a representative of the Australian people, has let her into the country. And basically, we've sort of assured her when she's come here that she'll have the protection of Australian law. And so to pose this cost on top of her and say, you know, unless you can pay this, you won't get to speak, is really different from the James Gunn case. But it's also really problematic in the sense that it incentivizes people to try and increase those costs of speaking, right? So the incentive here for, suppose she has to pay this $68,000, right? That's largely, that cost is incurred by her largely because a whole bunch of people didn't like what she was going to say and they wanted to cause a riot. They shut down a road. There had to be extra security around the event in case she got assaulted.
And she nearly did.
Yeah. And she nearly did. And so that's basically saying to those agitators, you know, or anyone who wants to shut down speech, agitate enough and you'll make it too costly for anyone to speak.
All right, cool. So there's another aspect to this James Gunn thing. So we talk about the Lawrence Allen stuff. So let's also look at it from another angle, which is this seems to be the first time, at least that I can remember, where it was a right-wing outrage mob that went after a left-wing director and got him fired. Like usually, like Roseanne Barr, pretty open Trump supporter, like the left-wing got her. There's other examples. Like I think we featured a Toby Young article.
Million examples.
Yeah, a Toby Young article in Hay today, which was like he got appointed to a school board, left Vandell these old articles, and they got rid of him as well.
I had to stop reading that, by the way. It was too long. That Toby Young thing, it was like 3,000 words.
5,500.
Didn't we just put that in Hay and say it was a really good piece?
It was a really good piece. Sorry.
Don't listen to Bushy.
It might be long, but if you can, like Bushnell's at work.
Definitely read the start of it.
Yeah, yeah. But Bushnell's at work, so he can't sit down for these things.
That's
but
right.
Yeah. Look, Toby Young's article is not the point. The point is, this brings up the thing of like, should the right wing get down in the mud with the left and be like, okay, if you're going to take down our Roseanne Barr's, we're going to take down your James Gunn's. Like, to me, this is a bit like, you know, with a Thomas More quote or whatever it is from the Man for All Seasons quote, which is like, you know, when you turn back to fight the devil, where are you going to hide if you've removed all of the laws or principles that you have? What do you make of that?
Well, and this is a real debate, I think, we're having on our side of politics at the moment.
And within the OPA office.
And I think, well, I mean, the simple answer to that is to say, well, the devil doesn't respect the law anyway. So you're not going to be able to hide behind the law when the devil comes. But I think I do personally find it a little bit problematic that we've become very censorious as a culture and we've sort of dropped our tolerance of people we disagree with. But it's important to remember that we didn't start that, right? This started because essentially conservatives have been told now for quite a long time that, and in particular over the last couple of years, that to have a conservative position on a whole raft of things is actually a form of violence, essentially, to say that if you support our existing institutions, and our existing institutions were built on a bedrock of violence, and they necessarily and inherently oppress other people, then by the transitive property, you're an oppressor, right? And I think that's a really dangerous argument. And the only way that you can really push back on that is to say, well, if the new rule is that we're going to really try and shame anyone who says anything different, and we really are talking about the devil, and the devil likes, you know, the devil hates nothing more than being mocked, right? So, and that's basically because the devil's major sin is pride, right? So if that's the case, if that's what we're up against, then mockery and making space for that mockery and trying to turn around this standard onto the people who've created it might be our only recourse.
But I don't really see what happened to James Gunn as mockery. Like, that seemed to be people, they weren't really doing satire. They were like, okay, we're going to bring you down and we're going to ruin your life based off these tweets I found from you 10 years ago.
Yeah, which is an idea about like imposing the same costs on people. So in a bizarre way, it's kind of like a restatement of equality. It's like, if this is the standard, then the standard's going to apply to you as well. And like I say, I don't think that necessarily we're being our best selves at the moment as a culture.
Yeah.
We should just morphed into a 15-year-old girl.
Well, I think, and if a 15-year-old girl had a voice that sounded like mine, you'd be somewhat disturbed, I think. But that aside, I think that, you know, we're not necessarily acting the way that we would in an ideal world. But this kind of, you know, you have to fight fire with fire. And I am very skeptical, I must admit, of the idea that people on our side of politics need to unilaterally disarm in the face of this growing outrage culture.
At a practical sense, if a couple of people start losing their jobs on that side, then it becomes too much of a cost for both sides to do it. You can make that argument. But from a personal perspective, I just can't cop adopting that victimhood cloak.
Yeah, and I just hate it. Like, I mean, James Gunn's tweets, like, disgusting. Obviously disgusting. And, you know, he was an edgy guy back then. He was making some very out there films. And, you know, there is a wider thing of, like, why did Marvel think that was the guy to do Guardians of the Galaxy? But, like, the fact is, I don't think those tweets 10 years ago in any way diminishes his ability to make a kick, like a really cool action movie next year. So I worry what's going to happen if all of these artists or all of these politicians, all of these people, if their lives are ruined and they're taken off the thing and you can't come back because of what you did 10 years ago, what, like, are we going to have great movies 10 years from now?
Yeah, but there's like a deeper issue here, right? Which is that this is the kind of thing that you're going to get the more that people talk about, say, corporations like Disney having a social license, right? Which is they're only allowed to operate if they embody certain values, right? That's what social license means. More and more, they're going to be very protective of their brands. You know, they're going to say, well, we're a very progressive company. We can't be associated with anything that diminishes our branding as progressive, as open to everyone, as inclusive, family friendly, all of these things that they've been told. I mean, the people who run these corporations have been told that this is how they maximize shareholder value, their profits, their growth, is to have this kind of messaging. And so, of course, they can't be associated with a guy who's edgy in a way that they're family friendly. Like, this is one of their franchises that's supposed to be, you know, it's kind of got a comedic touch. It's got,
yeah,
Vin Diesel says one word, which is, you know, great because his range is so limited.
Yeah, of all the Marvel movies, like, Guardians of the Galaxy is the one you bring your 7-year-old to. Like, maybe Thor, but it's basically they want you to go to Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, so I would say to anyone who's concerned about employers reading their branding and marketability this broadly, if anyone's concerned about that, then what they should really be concerned about is the idea that corporations have a social license and identity that they need to maintain in order to operate. Much better if we go back to the old system where corporations were like ruggedly capitalist and all they cared about was money and they didn't talk about anything but other than how they're going to make money.
Yeah.
That actually allowed a lot more freedom for the people who were inside those businesses to develop their own individual identities. You don't have an individual identity if your company really depends for its license to operate on its own progressive identity.
Yeah, I suppose, like, that's the reason I, like, just didn't really care about the James Gunn tweets, was just because I'm like, you know, I don't see Disney as having a social contract other than make a good movie.
Yeah, like, I think that's why people on our side of politics usually look at these things and just go, yeah, but I mean, I can easily separate James Gunn's personal sense of humor from this product that he's involved in creating.
Yeah.
People who are more like totalitarian and who really do see corporations as presenting this kind of, or needing to present this kind of united identity, then anything that splits off from that is going to be a problem.
To quote one that's in the news at the moment is like, one Starbucks calls the cops too quickly on a guy and suddenly Starbucks has a race problem.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's just like this one little outlet.
I was going to say, one of the reasons why, the other thing about this is ordinary people don't care, right? Ordinary people don't care if people are offensive or whatever, right? So, and one of the benefits of our side of politics is that we don't care either. So I think that we represent that more than the other side. But if we join in with that, then we no longer have that kind of franchise.
Yeah, their position does give more power to the sort of tastemakers in society, right? That this idea that there's like an official position that everyone must have, an official set of values that everyone must share, that lends itself to this kind of this problem of association. Like, if that's true, right, that that there's a set of values that everyone shares and any deviation from that is wrong, then guilt by association is actually valid. And that's what basically Disney are trying to do, is disassociate themselves from James Gunn so that there's no guilt on their part when he says something they don't like. What we need to do, I think, is we want to try and maintain a distinction between individual people and think about corporations as really a product of freedom of contract and not necessarily as living, breathing actors in a social organism that is, you know, destined to hit perfect progress or some, you know, left-wing kind of teleology like that.
Cool. I think that's a good place to end it. Bushnell, thank you so much for joining us. Sorry, the research report on South Australian community corrections is available on the IPA website, ipa.org.au.
Okay, we're here with Sean Jacobs, a 32-year-old guy from Brisbane who has achieved a lot so quickly in life, including being an international youth volunteer, ministerial advisor, United Nations consultant, security expert, and also someone who has written a book that we've just been reading here called Winners Don't Cheat. However, the point of that is Sean was a middle-of-the-road high school student before and didn't do well enough to get into university, but then since then has achieved so much. Including being, I noticed, a National Water Polo League champion. Sean, welcome to the program.
Cool. Thanks, gents. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, let's start with your journey. Tell us about how you did that, how you achieved such amazing things after being just a middle-of-the-road high school student.
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, I've always believed in this saying that if you don't know better, you can't do better. And I had a really slow start, as you mentioned, at a high school. I was a total medium-range performer. I was a decent water polo player, as you mentioned, and I failed to get into the Australian schools team, and I was really personally crushed. But looking back, I think I found myself in a place where a lot of young Australians can find themselves today, in that I didn't quite have the skills and experience compared to where I wanted to go. I think a lot about my rights at the time and not so much about my responsibilities. And I knew I had a degree of character inside me, but it hadn't quite been tested or refined yet. So, you know, bringing all these elements together, building skills, finding my aptitude, finding my passion, and I really bring those things together in my book, Winners Don't Cheat, and it tracks my journey from having this really slow start to, you know, doing some of the things that you've mentioned, so working for the Australian Aid Program in the South Pacific, working for the United Nations in PNG or in Port Moresby, where I was born, and then working for the National Security Advisor in Canberra. So it was really just about, in my own case, looking down the road, finding role models, again, like I mentioned, finding my aptitude, being committed to that lifelong learning, staying out of prison, which is some odd but good advice, and then just working hard as well.
Was there one sort of clear crystallising moment that you remember in your journey, sort of turning it around? Was there one moment or was it sort of a build-up of little moments along the way?
I think it was just kind of a build-up of different moments. There's sort of different instances where you just start to gain a bit of momentum. Look, one key thing for me was, like I mentioned, knowing better. And I was really fortunate in Year 12 to get an experience to go to Washington, D.C. On a youth leadership kind of program, and I got a chance to interact with a lot of students from around the world who were, like myself, just interested in current affairs and international affairs and politics and economics and history, and just see what they were doing. But then also seeing, you know, somewhere like Washington, D.C., where all these things intersect and how you can actually build a career. So that was a really good catalyzing moment. And then also, I guess, from my sport as well, about just bringing those sorts of disciplines of hard work and staying focused and bringing those sort of elements together. And like I mentioned, once you sort of you know, get a small win, that's a really good thing, and it can propel you to keep doing, you know, other things along the way. So probably a series of things, but if I had to nominate one sort of moment, that was it for me, that Year 12 moment in DC.
So you went to Washington, DC, the belly of the swamp, and you came out inspired to be a better person.
Yeah.
That's his biggest achievement.
Well, look, this is a few years ago now, so, you know, times have changed, I guess, but for some. Yeah.
All right, Sean. So this, I mean, a lot of the stuff in this book is kind of sort of, it actually reminded me a lot of Jordan Peterson. It's just sort of life advice for people. You kind of mentioned in your book that you feel like this is missing from a lot of people's lives, or a lot of young people's lives, particularly young men aren't getting this kind of advice or this kind of view. Do you want to just expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So look, when I get out there and speak to young people, or when I get sort of young professionals and even older people who have read the book, it's kind of interesting how little that they've actually absorbed these kinds of lessons just through general life or heard from people. And I think that's just really interesting. And, you know, you mentioned Jordan Peterson, and while Winners Don't Cheat it's not a book of lists or commandments, or, you know, you should do this and that sort of thing, or, it just tries to introduce these concepts to people, you know, especially young people. And again, it's just really interesting to hear that, you know, a lot of young people don't hear that lesson enough. And I think there's really a wide reception now, because those sorts of impulses that people have, you know, whether it's hard work, self-sufficiency, persistence, you know, taking responsibility, those are sorts of things that young people are just crying out for and is dying to hear, and especially young men in particular.
Yeah, cool. So in this book, there's a lot of input, or maybe stuff that you've sourced from other thinkers, other authors, other professionals as well, that sort that you collate and you can expand upon. Who are the people that really spoke to you, do you reckon? Like, who were the what were the quotes, or what were the examples that people were telling you or that you were reading about that really you thought were fantastic?
Yeah, sure. So look, I cite in the book, there's a chapter on resilience, and in that there's Margaret Thatcher. And I use the example of the coal strike of 1984. And, you know, Thatcher at that time, she'd come to power in 79, and she's facing all kinds of pressures, crime, terrorism, high unemployment, high inflation, and, you know, this coal strike that was just growing and growing. But what she did was years before, was back in 1979, actually start building up reserves of coal. And so when the actual big coal strike came, that what she was anticipating, she was able to rely on those reserves so that she couldn't bend to the will of the unions. And, you know, Thatcher, of course, is, you know, won the war of attrition, and she's one of the greatest leaders of the 20th century. But out of that was a really great lesson of resilience. And you're right, I've drawn a lot from, you know, economists like Thomas Sowell, for example, political leaders like John Howard, about, you know, principles first, method second, from even like Paul Keating, how to self-educate when you left school in, you know, at age 15 and be responsible for some of the biggest economic reforms that we've had. So, yeah, I do draw from a lot of different lessons, but, you know, people like Thatcher, Howard, you know, Keating, Thomas Sowell, even Clayton Christensen, the Harvard Business School innovation expert, you know, it's easy when you do a lot of reading, and which is what I did, and turning myself around, is look at a lot of people and try to draw lessons from different examples.
Now, a lot of the stuff in this book people recognise as kind of part of, I guess, like a conservative view of what a good life is and what a good life looks like. You yourself, I should have mentioned at the top, actually, you yourself were a candidate for a municipal election in the Brisbane City Council, I believe, as an LNP candidate. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes, I was back in 2016.
Right. So were you like brought up as a conservative, or did you come to it at some point? How did that sort of unfold?
Yeah. Look, my family's always been, I think, on the conservative side of politics. Never sort of really formally or in a card carrying sense, but in my own sort of development, I was really introduced to a lot of different ideas when I was younger, and I was really fortunate when I was young to be exposed to a lot of different cultures and different ideas. But really what helped me, though, was actually working in international development, and in my own instances, looking at how you need a state. You know, I'm a small government guy, but I do recognise the need for government and that kind of thing that enables people and doesn't, you know, I guess, suffocate or shut people down. And that was a really key thing for me, in terms of, you know, and at the same time reading about history and politics and economics, like we just mentioned, bringing those sorts of elements together, which really, I think, teased out that idea of, you know, cultivating stronger and better individuals, and then also which make you end up, I think, inevitably on a conservative or have a conservative impulse, because those ideas, those, you know, despite the comings and goings of new technology, I think it's really those ideas that hard work, self-sufficiency, persistence that really do carry you through regardless of the age and time that you're in.
Right. So, Sean, it seems like you're a rising star of, I guess, the movement. What's next for you?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I'm really focused now on just trying to get the message out in the book. You did mention at the top of the show, I do have security planning background. I've just finished working on the Commonwealth Games on the Gold Coast, which was certainly a challenge. And I guess I'm looking for my next big challenge in that kind of world. But I closed out the book, Winners Don't Cheat, with, you know, What's So Great About Australia. And I'm thinking about doing something that teases that out a little bit more about the legacy that we have in Australia and why, as an individual, there's so much good stuff to take advantage of.
So you talk about you want to spread the message that's in the book. Why do you think it is that there's so little of that message being said out there already? Like, why is it that these books need to come along? Or why is it that a Jordan Peterson needs to come along and restate these values?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think one of the, and you know, like if you ask Jordan Peterson this, for example, and his answer is that because for decades now, especially young people have been told, you know, constantly about their rights and not their responsibilities. And he said that, you know, that's one of the key reasons as to why he is, you know, so effective. I think his, you know, his work on, you know, compelled speech is actually what catapulted him into the public limelight, and then his work on, you know, self-responsibility and growing up, tidying up your room and those sorts of things is just getting a huge reception because of that sort of early popularity. But yeah, look, I think that that message out there is really propelled by this, you know, identity politics we see now. And I think that an element of self-esteem as well, where, you know, that feel-good optimism that a lot of young people may have been told about for you know, at least, you know, a few decades now, that doesn't matter what choices you make, you're still a decent, you're still a good person. And I think there's a little course correction on that, and that's why we're seeing this sort of thing coming back into vogue now.
Sean, of course, your book was published by the wonderful people at Connoisseur Publishing. Where can people get a copy of it if they want one? And also, how can people get a listen to your podcast?
Oh, great. Look, just go to the Connor Court website. It should be on the landing page there and feature as a new book out. And for the podcast or even for the book as well, they can go to seanjacobs.com.au and then just click on book or even just go to the podcast there, which are on the landing page as well.
All right, cool. Sean Jacobs, author of Winners Don't Cheat. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Right. Thanks very much, gents. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you to Andrew Bushnell and Sean Jacobs for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. So we'll fly through some stories and made us laugh this week. If I may start, Pete.
You should kick it off, mate.
Thank you, Ben. So this one got a fair bit of play out of some reporting from the Daily Telegraph. So I don't know if you guys are on Instagram. I joined this week. Finally buckled.
Here we go.
Sorry, you go on. Well, anyway, so like Instagram is mostly people posting about how much they work out, I think would be a fair thing to say. Like, there is a massive industry in just posting yourself working out, posting yourself being fit, and you'll get followers based off that. So it is one of the most successful industries going right now, and like a new industry thing.
Is this why you got into it?
No. I got into it because, you know, it was time. It was time.
What do you mean it was time?
Well, I don't know. Like,
you've been thinking about it.
Yeah. We'll talk off.
Are you on Insta?
Yeah.
Okay,
so yeah, we just follow each other.
Yeah, it's a young IPA podcast. Yeah, Nina and I follow each other now.
Where's your Pete?
I'm not on Insta.
Yeah, they need to find a new word for that. Like, I follow you on Insta. It just sounds a bit creepy. But anyway, this is not the point. The point is, fitness posting is a huge thing on Instagram. The federal government has now decided to subsidize it. So it comes out of the Daily Telegraph. The federal government, since 2016, has spent $718,000 on paying social media influencers, basically just these fitness people, to post about how they're fit.
Yeah.
Like, they were doing that anyway. The government has now decided to put $700,000 of taxpayer money into
it. Well, where would we be without them, James? That's the point.
Like, the influencers are paid up to, like, $3,000 per post when, you know, like, they were just, again, they were doing it anyway.
Yep.
Companies were coming in saying, hey, wear our sneakers, put a post about it, and we'll pay you.
It's like the broadband of Instagram.
Like, you know, when
NBN,
government, when the government gets subsidizing things, it's usually because the industry is failing anyway. But, they've gone, this is really successful. Let's give it money. I just don't get it.
They might have just wanted to be cool.
They might have just wanted to meet some of the social media influencers.
They might have.
I'm not going to lie. Like, that's where I'm thinking. Pete, let's go to another story.
All right, so this is, as you know, that's quite funny, Bath University in Somerset, England have banned the words, as you know. They've held an Equality and Diversity Network meeting where it's decided the words, as you know, will be barred from class. During the meeting, a video was screened for the staff called Why Is My Curriculum White?, which sounds like an absolute cracker, and the idea behind the controversial ban is that it makes certain students feel inadequate and stupid if they don't know what the professor is actually talking about.
So they banned the as you know.
Yep.
Yeah, you can't say as you know because it's going to make students feel stupid. What I want to know is, why is this part of, like, why is my curriculum white? Is there something racial to saying as you know?
I don't know.
Like, is that a racist thing now?
Don't think so.
Like, it's like I don't like it when people say as you know. It's annoying. Like, if something is prefaced with as you know, then don't say it.
That's like, you don't like sentences starting with clearly.
Or obviously, or as I said before, or per my last email. It's like, yeah, I read it. Like, anyway, so I just don't get why it's like, why is my curriculum white? And I also like the idea that like someone says as you know, and suddenly you're just like, I can't study anymore. This has really thrown me off.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, a few doses of feeling stupid and inadequate were really beneficial to my education. Maybe think, you know, I need to actually work out what is going on here.
Yeah, well, so maybe we need more of it. Maybe we should start the podcast with as you know, and then Pete just, he hits it. Cool. So I got another one here. So Trevor Noah, last week we discussed how Trevor Noah got himself in a bit of Twitter hot water talking about how Africa won the World Cup instead of France. And then he, you know, had the to-and-fro with the French ambassador, and he wound it back saying both sides. Anyway, you can go listen to last week's show and leave it a 5-star review. But anyway, this week, he's got himself in the hot water again. So he's about to make a tour through Australia, a stand-up tour. And
get him on the show.
Yes, absolutely. And so then people have started to tweet out some of these old routines from 2013. So, I mean, this is a bit like the James Gunn thing. Not the best jokes about Aboriginal women.
They are terrible.
Don't want to repeat too many. One I will repeat just to give you an idea of how this bad it is. And I'm like, because like this sentence, while imitating the sound of a didgeridoo to imply he was talking about oral sex, like that's bad. You don't want to be doing that. It's not funny. And but it's Trump's the reason why there's racism in the world right now.
Well, how does this guy go on TV and make money out of saying Trump is racist?
Yeah, exactly.
They are terrible tweets.
These were like stand-up jokes in front of a crowd. Like, tweets of just like, you know, I'm going to yell this into my phone and then go back to whatever I was doing. He's like, there's 200 people who want to hear this joke.
And I don't reckon, like, it's not like, oh, well, it was a different time back then. It was only 2013.
No, 2013. Like, everyone knew that's not the kind of thing you should be joking about. But anyway, like, you know, stand-ups have bad routines, is my point. And if he does this joke, and you know, I like again, I don't care, and like he shouldn't lose his job and all this stuff. But yeah, it's what gets to me is when he does say,
yeah,
like,
so
yeah, when Roseanne Barr tweeted out the stuff that got her fired, Trevor Noah said, "Well, I blame Trump because Trump tweets, and then his followers do this, and like we all start losing our minds." It's like, dude, Trump didn't make you say that in 2013. Like, exactly. Sometimes, yeah, just put down the sheriff's badge for 1 second and realize you're not an angel. Would be my point. Yes, what I'll say to him when he's on the show.
Trevor, stop thinking you're an angel.
Yeah. I'll say that to him when he's on the show. Cool. So should we talk plastic straws once again? Yes. Strawman arguments. It's been a while, and I was hoping we were out of it because I'm kind of over this. But anyway, like, this is a good one.
It rolls on. And it's right. We do a lot of straws, and you know, Nanny gets fired up and we have to contain her and, you know, settle down. Anyway, Santa Barbara in California, if a restaurant hands out a straw, they get fined, right? That's the first offense. But if they have a second offense, he or she could face a fine not exceeding $1,000 or imprisonment not exceeding 6 months. So you can go to jail for the straws, people. Be careful.
Well, when I first read that article, it's like, I thought the entire restaurant just went to jail. Like, they just put like a giant prison cell over the restaurant. It's like, you guys are bad. Stop handing out plastic straws. But it is like the proprietor. But yeah, like we were joking the whole time about like, oh, plastic straws, how funny. And this one's a little far.
Yeah, this is no longer funny.
Yeah.
What would Bushy do, though, you know, in criminal justice approach to the straws?
I think he'd be against it. That would be my guess.
Yeah, probably.
All right, cool. How are we going for time? Because this one is very stupid.
8:53. Oh, no, I've got heaps of time.
Okay. all right, so if this doesn't work, we'll cut it. And if it does work, then I don't know. For the listeners out there, it's a bit of show you're working. You get to see how the sausage is made. But anyway, enough. Preface of this. Sorry, Nina. Now, I've already talked to Pete about this because it came up, but we haven't talked to you about this. Let me set this story straight. Sorry. I take you to Egypt right now. There's like this archaeological dig. You might be familiar with this one. It did get a lot of play on the internet.
Yeah.
But they've gone into this one tomb, and they like there seems to be this inscription that promises like a world-ending plague if you open the tomb.
Yeah.
Now, these archaeologists, they open the tomb.
Yeah.
They're not afraid. In it are three skeletons and all of this red liquid.
Yeah.
Now, this sarcophagus hasn't been opened for 2,000 years. This is a 2,000-year-old liquid.
Yeah.
Then started a internet petition to let us drink the liquid.
Woohoo.
Would you what would it take you guys? Open question to debate. What would it take you to drink that liquid?
You go first, Nana.
Just one sip. Just like I fill up like those medicine things, like the...
Uh-huh.
And then just one drop.
What would it take me to...
What would it take you?
Oh,
Now, it's potentially cursed.
Yeah.
It is at least 2,000 years old, and it's red for some reason.
Yeah. Promise of immortality, I suppose.
Yeah, because, well, that's part of the thing. It's like,
not like money.
Look.
Like, what do I do? Like, if I'm got cursed, am I going to die?
Prove
like,
her wrong.
What am I going to do with the money anyway?
Nina could be the wrath of the ancient Egyptians immortalized on Earth.
Yeah.
Spreading pestilence in her wake.
So I'm like, it better be making me live immortality.
So
like,
you'll take the risk.
I'll take the risk.
Yeah, so you're doing it for free?
No, she's doing it for immortality.
No, but like, we don't know that.
You yeah,
don't know
no, what to do. But we'll have to take it.
She wants the promise.
See, I'm with Nina.
Like, there's no point to have like $1 million.
Yeah, out of.
If I can. I cannot do anything with.
If you become immortal.
Yeah, if I become immortal, I can rule the world, man.
Yeah, exactly. That's what. See, I'm.
You wouldn't rule the world. You'd just be the same for
see
forever.
The big picture here.
No, you have to
see the big picture.
You're telling me if Nina isn't immortal, she's not immediately queen of the world.
I'll get no all those plastic straws back in the way they belong.
This is how we defeat plastic straws. That was going to be my follow-up. I was going to say, if you guys were saying I wouldn't drink it, Pete, you wouldn't drink it, would you?
I'd drink it for like $100.
You went down from a million very quickly. You raised $1 million.
Well, I was going to say a million. Like, I'd do it.
What if you had to do it out of a plastic straw, though?
Yeah.
The last plastic straw on Earth.
Oh, and you got fired.
I would see that if it was the last plastic straw on Earth, it would be worth heaps.
Yeah.
So if I get to keep it, I'll do it for the straw. Because that would be
disposable, though. Me and Nina, we would do it out of nothing more than
curiosity.
Yeah.
You might turn into an ancient Egyptian god.
Yeah.
You don't want to take that chance?
Yeah.
Well, I'd still reckon if they're going to let me, like, they'd pay me $100 to do it.
Yeah.
So I'd take both.
Anyway. Oh, by the way, the liquid's not 2,000 years old anyway.
How do we know that, though?
It's apparently, because it was building, like, around it, isn't it? And there's a leak, a pipe leak, and then there's like a hole.
You don't want to tell us at the start of the segment?
Yeah. I just felt like Santa Claus. I just got told Santa Claus was.
I just remember
I was like,
that.
Oh my god, this 2,000-year-old liquid. Oh my god.
Yeah. So all right,
cool. We've abused our listeners' time, but hopefully, I don't know. Send me an email, jbold@ipa.org.au. Would you drink the liquid? That's the subject line. I wouldn't drink the liquid.
Yeah.
Cool. That's it for this week's show. Thank you to Sean Jacobs and Andrew Bushnell for those interviews. You can read Andrew Bushnell's parliamentary research brief on our website. You can also buy Sean Jacobs' book, Why Winners Don't Cheat. Second up, stuff that up. Winners Don't Cheat.
Great book.
That's the book. You can buy that from Connor Court Publishing. You can also listen to his podcast on iTunes. So that is it for the show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through Spotify. So if you have had that friend who you've said you're going to really like this show, and they say, I don't have iTunes, Spotify, get them on that. That's how they can subscribe. That's how they can listen from now on. And if you are listening on iTunes, leave us a 5-star review, and that helps us out of the rankings. You can also leave a comment. You can tell us in the comment whether or not you drink the juice.
Yep.
You would. I would. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that again. So Nina, if people want to make a financial commitment to the IPA, if they want to support what we're doing, how can people get involved?
Well, just become a member or give someone the membership. Just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on that join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Cool. See you guys next week.
Stay up.